Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, how many Sephardic families live in Amsterdam now? In 1492, Spain expelled its Jewish population. Many who fled to Portugal were nevertheless forcibly baptized after 1496. More than 100 years later, their descendants, victims of the Inquisition who wished to live as Jews, began to arrive in Amsterdam. At that time, the Dutch Republic was at war with Spain, so to avoid being identified with the Spanish enemy, these refugees from the Iberian Peninsula called themselves Portuguese Jews. There were originally three Sephardi communities. The first, Beth Jacob, already existed in 1610, and perhaps as early as 1602. Neve Shalom was founded between 1608 and 1612 by Jews of Spanish origin. The third community, Beth Israel, was established in 1618. Eventually, in 1639, they merged to form Talmud Torah, the Portuguese Jewish community of Amsterdam, which still exists today. Portuguese Jews played a significant part in the cultural and economic development of the Dutch Republic. Moreover, they enjoyed a freedom of religion unique in Jewish history. The community produced rabbis, scholars, philosophers, artists, and bankers, as well as founders and trustees of major international commercial companies. The site of the present synagogue, the Esnoga or Snoja, was acquired in 1670 and construction work began the following year. On August 2, 1675, the Snoga was solemnly inaugurated. The cultural heritage of the Portuguese synagogue includes the Etzheim Library, which contains valuable historical Sephardic documents. The synagogue also has a collection of dazzling ritual objects made of gold, silver, copper, and valuable textiles that the Portuguese Jewish community has produced over the course of more than four centuries. This collection of approximately 800 objects is so unique that it's been designated as a protected collection and is covered by the Cultural Heritage Preservation Act in its entirety. A unique characteristic of Amsterdam's Portuguese synagogue is that electricity has never been installed there, and at night it's lit by hundreds of burning candles. Aside from religious services, spectacular candlelight concerts are held there. We spoke with David Nunes Navarro, the shamash, or sexton of the synagogue, about the building itself and Amsterdam's Sephardic community. During our interview, he used some Hebrew words, and since many of our listeners might not understand some of them, I've interjected the English translations. Thank you very much for speaking with us today. Could you first give us a little overview of the origin of the Portuguese Jews in Amsterdam, the Sephardic Jews?
Sephardic Jews came from the Iberian area, and they wandered over Europe, ended up in various countries, and for one reason or the other, our community and our Snoga, in Dutch Snoga, is the main icon of Western Sephardic Judaism.
When was the synagogue built?
They started building in 1672, and the opening was supposed to be in 1674, but due to the war with Spain, It was delayed 1 year, so in 1675 there was the opening.
Do you know how many people there were at the beginning?
In the very beginning, I don't know. I know there was in the very, very beginning a minyan, an illegal minyan. So there were very few, but at the top of the influx of the Sephardi Jews, one speaks about 5,000 people.
Can you tell us about other Jewish, other Sephardic institutions here, for example, the cemetery?
Yeah, the cemetery is a very ancient and important cemetery, which gives a lot of information about the history of the Dutch Sephardic Jews. In the very, very beginning, non-Jews were not willing to sell the land to the Jews, and so they planned the auction on Shabbat, on the Saturday. But we found a good solution. We hired a non-Jew,
a Shabbos goy,
who bid on the Shetach, on that area, yes. Land, and so we got it in our possession. And in the very, very beginning of the coming of the Ashkenazim, they were not able to bury their people on a cemetery. They had no money. So in the very beginning, there were also Ashkenazi Jews buried.
And so now, is it mostly Sephardic?
That is, it's mostly Sephardic for what's left. Mm-hmm. Because our ancient families have almost vanished. And we're accepting members of Ashkenazi descent.
To the synagogue, you mean?
To the synagogue. So they also get buried on our cemetery.
How many synagogues are there in Amsterdam, do you know? And how many are Sephardic and how many Ashkenazi, or do you just mingle?
In Greater Amsterdam, there are 12 or 13 synagogues. There are two Spanish Portuguese. The one here in the center tries to cling on the real thing. At least I must specify that. I'm sure that if there would have not been a Second World War, we would have evolved normally new melodies, other customs also would have been put aside and introduced. But because of the war, it's a standstill. It's like it's frozen
in time
as if it is 1940, 41. For instance, the top hats we're still wearing. I'm quite sure that if there would have not been no war, nobody would have put up a top hat anymore.
So what you're saying is that people are trying to hold on to the traditions that were interrupted.
Yes, as people can remember, as after the war, there were people who, everybody has had his opinion after the war. And it was also the chief rabbi was from Den Haag, the Spanish Portuguese synagogue. And it was a little bit different than here. So he kept quite silent about that. But I still remember the infighting on Shabbat. It was like this, no, it was like that. Which every good Jewish community and synagogue has. Yes. It means you are still alive. It's the machloikis.
Small disputes.
That binds us together. So in that sense, we try to restore and keep it like that. And I give you an example. Last Shabbat was Shabbat B'Shalach, in which it's sung the Shirat Hayom.
The Torah portion of the week, in this case, the Song of the Sea.
Where Moses is in front with the Jewish people of the Red Sea, you see, in English. In Dutch it's called different, that's why. And that's the only Shabbat in the whole year that we don't sing the Shira as a kahal, as a community. All other Shabbatot we do. But not everybody knows, so some people start singing it. And then we decided not to have fights during the service. So then we join in, but the real thing is that we don't sing it. There are only four people who know that.
Well, maybe you should tell the other people beforehand.
Yes, but then you need to have an ego that allows you to tell, to accept that somebody has a different opinion about that, and that's a big problem.
About how many Sephardic Jews are there in Amsterdam now? Do you have any idea?
No, but very, very. And you mean not from Israel, because we have a huge influx of Sephardi Israelis. So then, if I don't count that, then I think that maybe 20, 30 families you have it, if at all. We have 600 members, 500-600 members, but they are not Sephardi at all.
So you have a lot of Israelis who've come to Amsterdam to settle here?
Well, Israelis never settle. They're always on their way back and on the move. And Israelis are not used to be a member of a kahal and pay a yearly fee. So, and in their minds, they're always back home with Ima.
Mommy.
So they are 1 foot here. And one foot in Israel, so that's why they cling together. And a few come to synagogue, and for most of them, it's a relief that they don't go to synagogue anymore since they're in Amsterdam.
Do you have any idea of what the percentage of the Jewish population is Sephardic, and what percentage is Ashkenazi? Is it overwhelmingly Ashkenazi?
Today, yes. Overwhelmingly.
You mentioned World War II. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened during and after World War II to the, especially Sephardic community?
When this area where we're sitting now was cleaned out because it was given to the Jewish Historical Museum, they cleaned out the archives, and in one little notebook was found. They used to work here in Nabarro in the office. And he wrote the effects what the Nazi laws had on this community. So it says, Mr. Our secretary had to register and to go to away, so to Westerbork, which was a camp. Westerbork was the one they collected, and from there sent to the concentration camps. And you see, I had it in my hands, and it was shocking to read it, that every statement has its huge impact on the functioning of this community. And the last line is about somebody that this and this doesn't function anymore, and then it stops. So he was taken away. Okay. So it has been emptied slowly and painfully. And where people after the war, who were very religious before the war and after the war, they didn't do anything anymore, which is of course a personal tragedy. Mm-hmm. And so what, how can I say, the impact, it's huge, and felt till today. And although I welcome all Ashkenazi, it's never going to be the same. So we are trying to keep up our traditions, taking into account other people's wishes.
What kind of special activities do you have? Do you have anything special for the children? Are there children?
Well, that's a very painful point. There are almost no children. So if you look at the statistics and you extrapolate that to the future, somewhere over there is a dead end. Because if there are no children, then there's no future. There are a few families with children, and we try to get more families and more people, but from our own inner circle, it's really not a healthy...
Yes, it's diminishing.
Diminishing, yeah, it's diminishing.
Do you have any relationships with other Sephardic communities, either in Holland or in other countries?
That's still lacking, but we're working on that. We're going to broaden our... this community was always inward. And I always explain that these low buildings around the Snoga, that's our world, but we have no option but to go out of the gate and connect to other Spanish, Portuguese, and Sephardic communities. And it will happen from now on.
Is there anybody here who speaks Ladino?
Not anymore. No, 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 no. The last person who could speak Ladino was a Turkish Jew, born in Amsterdam, but his father came. And he's Ladino from Turkey.
Changing the subject, can you tell us about the synagogue itself, the physical synagogue? What does it look like? What is there? What can someone see if they come?
First of all, if you're from the outside and you look at the building, you see a huge building with typical windows. And when you enter the gate, you enter, you take the same footsteps of great chachamim and rabbanim,
sages and rabbis,
and very pious people, which you have to remember when you enter that magnificent building. It's a shrine. Our own people, our own community members never realized that for Haredim and for learned and pious people, this community has a great name because of the publications of our Chachamim. And they understand by visiting this synagogue. It's like going to, it's maybe not a level, but people go to the Kever of Rachel Imenu,
the tomb of the matriarch Rachel.
And they don't just go there because it's so cozy, and it's not. Yes. But they have a certain feelings with that, comes with that. And in the same order, why do Haredim and Dati people want to see the synagogue and go there? They want to be in the footsteps of great Chachamim who wrote books that if they would not have been written by them, the Jewish world today would not have been the same as before. For them, this is a changing moment in Jewish history and literature. And when you're in the building itself, it's overwhelming, the space, the pillars, the teba, the bima.
The frontispiece covering where the Torah is kept, and the lectern,
which is, in our custom, in the back of the synagogue. High, it's higher, much higher than the floor.
Like it's fun.
Like it's fun. And with an Avon HaKodesh.
The cupboard where the Torah is kept.
So impressive. It's made of a special wood from Brazil, I heard.
Brazil.
And it's an... you get silent from it when you really understand what you're seeing and where you are in now. Another thing is that here was a strict order of... I would almost say like the caste system in India. For instance, the important people, or at least the people who thought they were important, were sitting in the middle. I would say the ship, we call it het schip in Dutch. The ma'amad,
the patrons of the community,
was sitting on the in a higher bench on the left side, near the wall, looking over the people, and a little bit higher sitting than the Rabbanim. So the rabbis here were always less important than the board. The orphans, they were not allowed to sit in the building. They had to sit next to the wall. Mm-hmm. And a sad story to make you aware of the system. Before the war, there were multiple shabashim. The chatanim for Simchat Torah,
the men who have the honor of holding the Torah,
were always from wealthy families who could afford to give a good kiddush,
the toast after the morning service,
etc. And not everybody was invited. So during the morning service, invitations were handed out in Snoga to the people who were invited to the kiddush in the morning. So you can imagine sitting in Snoga, it's cold, it's winter time, left to you, somebody gets an invitation, the right of you, somebody gets an invitation, and after the morning service, before reading of the Torah, people go here to have fun, kiddush, eat, and most of the people are sitting in Snoga and waiting for them to come back. Today, that's impossible, unthinkable.
Yes.
But it used to be like that. And my father was an orphan, and he grew up in the Beit Yatomim of the Kehila.
The orphanage of the community.
And it was called Abi Yatomim.
He was born here in Amsterdam?
He was born in Den Haag, The Hague. And at age 3, he was sent to the orphanage because his father died and his mother... Today we know it's a stroke, because she couldn't recognize him anymore. Mm-hmm. She was paralyzed, so in those days, it was not so known. And because the boys of the Beit Yatomim went every time to Snoga here, my father got very attached to Snoga.
Yes.
That's how he knew the services. And he learned on the seminary before the war. So after the war, he came back and found an emptied Snoga. You can call it yeshiva, but yeshiva is maybe... this was a seminary where you learned... In yeshiva, they turn around. They learn Gemara. And Tanakh, they know nothing. Almost nothing.
Nothing.
And Dikduk.
Hebrew grammar.
It's alien to them. Here, the system of education was that the Chachamim gave education of Dikduk to the little children. To know that the fundament of the language is solid. Mm-hmm. And then they learn Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, Kutuvim.
The Pentateuch, Prophets, and Psalms.
And if you go higher up in the studies, then you go to Gemara, but it's the last thing.
And so he became a cantor.
He became a cantor. After the war, he volunteered in doing the services. And I saw the contract once, I have it at home. If I'm not mistaken, it was 47 that he got his first salary. Not worth mentioning. But then he was the chazan, became the chazan of the community.
Is there anything else you would like to tell us that we might have left out?
Oh, I'm sure we've left out so much.
Most of it.
Most of it. Well, what I hope is that if people hear this interview, very short interview, that they will think of that this is a very poor community, contrary to what one thinks, mm-hmm. because we had in history wealthy times, mm-hmm. but today it's a very poor community, and they can have a look online on the Snoha, not to be mixed with the museum, and they can make royal donations to our community and come and visit on Shabbat and spend the Shabbat with us.
Thank you very much. Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is English Corner at RadioSefarad.com. See you next week.